All across Wisconsin from Civic Media, this is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
Well, hey there, Wisconsin. Good morning. Welcome to the State of Wiscommon Sense. It is Friday, March 10th. Happy birthday, Sherry. It's another beautiful day on Lake Wissota because the snow that we got was basically white Christmas snow. You know, just enough here that if it were, you know, a couple of days before Christmas and you needed that nice, pretty coating, it would do the trick. But that's also because we were at the very northern edge of what rolled through here compared to Aaron Zommers, who was somewhere near the bullseye. And I think he would disagree with my assessment that it's wonderfully romantic and light and lovely Christmas snow.
Yeah, I got to say that looking at what was on top of my car, it was probably close to that maximum of 7 or 8 inches.
What do you mean maximum? Like your roof would cave in or what?
Sure, let's go with that. No, I mean the maximum forecast.
Oh, okay, gotcha. All right. Well, good. Well, I'm glad that the car made it. Again, any drive you can walk away from is a good one. Trump's Judge Whisperer is coming to Wisconsin. That's one of the stories we've got coming up this morning. We're going to talk about a guy named Leonard Leo. Leonard Leo is the most powerful man you've never heard of. He's a key player in getting justices on the U.S. Supreme Court specifically tailored to kill Roe v. Wade, which meant, of course, they had to lie about it to get on the court. But it was Leonard Leo who helped identify the people who would sink that low to get to a position that high. Courier Newsroom national correspondent Kia Vakil joins us later this hour to tell us how Leonard Leo is now getting active on behalf of right-wing former Justice Dan Kelly in the Wisconsin Supreme Court election, which will also determine the future of women's health care rights in Wisconsin. In our next hour, Wendy Strout, the Wisconsin director for the Human Rights Campaign PAC, talks about the significant stakes for the LGBTQ community in the April 4th Supreme Court race, as well as a special election in the Milwaukee area for a state Senate seat. We'll also talk to Mark Jacob, a former editor with the Chicago Tribune. He has this Friday overview of how the national media has been covering the big stories of the week. And as always, they're not exactly getting a B+, shall we say, for their coverage. We will get an updated weekend forecast from weatherology meteorologist Michael Cairo. And UW Eau Claire Athletic Director Dan Schumacher should be joining us at the end of the show to help us look ahead to the weekend in sports. And I'll actually have a couple of sports headlines for you in just a sec here. Again, if you'd like to join the show at any point on what we're talking about, so many ways to do it, to join or to give us your input. You can call us at 844-967-2789, or the Up North line is 715-388-7155. Our email address is radio@upnorthnewswi.com. And if you are watching the live video feed of this radio show on one of three different Facebook pages, you can leave a comment on that post where you see the live feed, and we might feature it up here on screen. Those are the Facebook pages for Up North News and for Civic Media and for Bull Falls Radio. That's our station in Wausau. And we're glad to have everybody along across the Civic Media Radio Network on this Friday as we wrap up this first full week of March. In sports, the Milwaukee Bucks did beat the Brooklyn Nets last night, 118-113. Brooke Lopez was the quintessential brick wall. 9 blocked shots, most in the NBA this season. Bobby Portis had 28 points. And again, Giannis is out with a sore wrist. Now, get this for a historical statistic from the game. I don't know it. I don't watch the NBA enough to know what is a typical number for how many points come off the bench as opposed to the points from your starting five. But the Nets have had so many players banged up that their starting five last night scored a combined 15 points. That's the fewest by a starting lineup since 2008. But that also means that the Nets last night had 98 bench points. 98 of their 113 points came off the bench. That is the most ever since the NBA started tracking starters versus bench players back in the 1970-71 season. And the Bucks had opened up a huge lead. I watched enough of this in the early going. It was just raining threes early on. But Brooklyn came almost all the way back. And it was really thanks to Lopez and those blocked shots that really made the difference. Now the Bucks will play at Golden State come Saturday night. And let's see, the Marquette Golden Eagles in the Big East tournament, they're the number one seed, and they nearly made an early exit, nearly lost to number eight seed Butler in the quarterfinal at Madison Square Garden. It went to overtime. Marquette was able to pull it out, 72-70. So the Golden Eagles will advance now to play UConn in the first semifinal tonight. And again, that's at Madison Square Garden. And the UConn is ranked 11th in the country. So this is going to be a really good game for folks to check out. In just a bit here, we're going to talk about International Women's Day, which was 2 days ago. But I'd mentioned back on Wednesday, I said, well, maybe the next day we'll come back and we'll wrap up some of the activities. And we didn't get a chance to do that yesterday. So when we come back, I'm going to talk a bit about International Women's Day, which is a much bigger deal in many other countries around the world than it is here in terms of activities and especially protests, as women continue to fight for rights that they should have had a long time ago. And later we'll hear from Congressman Mark Pocan blasting Republicans for continuing to bully and try to eliminate trans athletes and trans kids. All that and much more on a busy Friday here on Up North News Radio. We'll be right back. So International Women's Day was celebrated all around the world on Wednesday, highlighting the unfinished work of providing equity for half of the planet's population. And I still sometimes can't believe I have to say that out loud. While activists in some places celebrated their political and legal advances, observances also pointed to repression in countries such as Afghanistan and Iran, and the large number of women and girls who experience sexual assaults and domestic violence globally. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres noted this week that women's rights were abused, threatened, and violated all around the world, and that gender equality won't be achieved for 300 years, given the current pace of change. Progress won over the decades is vanishing in part, he said, because, quote, the patriarchy is fighting back. And I already hear what some of you are saying, and you're absolutely right. Yeah, I mentioned Afghanistan and Iran and some other countries, but even in countries where women have considerable freedom, there have been setbacks. This is the first International Women's Day since the U.S. Supreme Court ended the constitutional right to abortion last year, and many states have adopted or re-implemented significant restrictions on women's health rights, including Wisconsin, with a law that was written in 1849. Here are a few examples of what took place around the world. In Japan, women's rights activists held a small rally to renew their demand for the government to allow married couples to keep using different surnames. Here's another one of those cases with a law from the 19th century. In Japan, under the 1898 Civil Code, a couple must adopt the surname of the husband or wife at the time of marriage, but surveys in Japan show majority support for both men and women keeping their own names. But they can't do that right now under the law. In the Philippines, hundreds protested a gender pay gap that continues to grow wider in that country. In Turkey, women in Istanbul tried to demonstrate for their rights. They were met by police who fired tear gas and arrested several people, similar to events there in past years. In Albania, hundreds of women in Kosovo's capital protesting domestic violence threw smoke bombs at the police headquarters, accusing police, the prosecutor's office, and the courts of gender discrimination when it comes to investigating violence against women. And tens of thousands of people marched in Paris and other French cities demanding equal pay now. Women's salaries in France are, on average, 16% below men's. So there's a lot of progress yet to be made. And I said, you know, after the Dobbs decision, I'd said every election from this point on, women's rights will be on the ballot. Something I remember, again, as a kid, hearing about the Equal Rights Amendment and the back and forth about that as it, you know, went to the states for ratification and in many cases did not get ratified and it did not become a part of the Constitution. But there also seemed to be continued advances in women's rights that we haven't really used the term women's rights lately until, as the UN Secretary General mentioned, the patriarchy started fighting back, and now we're backsliding in this country as well as others. And so, much like every election day from here to the foreseeable future is going to be about women's rights, I firmly believe International Women's Day is going to get better and better known here in this country as well, as women try to get out of the second-class status that a few right-wing justices put them into last year. One other national note I wanted to pass along, and it's about the budget. We have talked about the state budget here, and now we're going to talk about the federal one. In both cases, it's a blueprint for, you know, who's going to get what over the coming year from your state or your federal government? How do you allocate those resources? Because in the end, that's really what it's all about, is, you know, what are you investing in? And it's like Joe Biden always talks about his father saying, you know, don't tell me your values, show me your budget, and that'll tell me what your values are. Well, Joe Biden put out his budget, and it's a little late, but it's still ahead of the Republicans, who still haven't put out a plan. They've been demanding cuts. They've been criticizing Biden for spending, just like Republicans in Madison have been criticizing Governor Evers for spending and demanding more austerity. But in both cases, the Republicans won't put out an actual plan. So yesterday, President Biden did put out his plan. It's a nearly $7 trillion budget that, according to the New York Times headline, doubles down on the power of government. And that really, when you look at the difference between Democrats or Republicans or progressives and conservatives, it really is, the division is people who believe government is we. What do we want to do? What do we want to do with this money? What do we want to do with our priorities? And the other side of the spectrum believes government is them. Government is this distant and hostile entity that must be fought and cut. Joe Biden believes in the power of government, the effectiveness of government when it's done right, when it's managed by people with competence and compassion. This budget is not in keeping with the Republican plan of trying to cut your way to prosperity. Quite the opposite. This budget contains about $5 trillion in proposed tax increases on high earners and corporations over the course of the next decade. And that's mostly to offset new spending intended to help the middle class and low-income households. For example, this new budget proposal from President Biden calls for a new 25% minimum tax on billionaires. In other words, while some people, when they get six-figure job, and I mean the low six figures, maybe they're making $150,000, $200,000 a year, you know, they'll be paying a certain tax rate, and billionaires will still be paying a lot less. And President Biden is saying, you know, you're going to pay at least 25%. We're going to close a bunch of these loopholes that keep you from paying your fair share. There would be an increase in the corporate tax rate from 21% currently to 28% would be the new tax bracket for corporations. And again, right away, folks are saying, wait a minute, what's that going to do to the cost of a cheeseburger? Now, we never hear that when the McDonald's CEO is getting another multi-million-dollar contract or a golden parachute or more stock options or whatever the case may be. So it seems to be a bit of a canard here. It's really a matter of what is a fair tax rate for billionaires? What's a fair tax rate for corporations? What's the fair tax rate on stock buybacks? This matter of stock buybacks has been an absolute killer, and I would contend in many ways a literal killer over the past 40 years. By making it more advantageous for companies to buy back their own stock in order to increase its value to shareholders, rather than taking that money and investing it in their company, investing it in their people, investing it in their infrastructure, making improvements, and instead they're buying back their own stock. So I think it's far past time that you try to even the scales a bit. And much like we do with interest rates, we're trying to cool inflation. When you try to cool inflation, you increase interest rates. It's going to hurt some people, but it's also going to slow down spending because that's what's driving inflation. So hopefully you're curtailing some of the less necessary spending, as it were. Well, the same goes on these stock buybacks. Right now, the tax on that is 1%. And President Biden's budget proposal increases the tax on stock buybacks to 4%. Not really a killer, is it? It would also eliminate the tax treatment of carried interest, the thing that allows private equity and hedge fund executives to pay lower tax rates than many of their salaried employees. And it would block billionaires from using retirement savings accounts as tax shelters. Biden's plan also aims to reduce budget deficits. That's right. Along with the tax increases, along with the new spending on middle class and low income households, when all is said and done, the budget deficit would actually be reduced $3 trillion over the next 10 years compared with the current path. How do you do that? Well, in part, in something that, again, would benefit the middle class, more aggressive negotiation over prescription drug prices. The White House estimates that those changes and some other tweaks to the drug negotiation provision would save the government an additional $200 billion over 10 years. And that money would go to the Medicare Trust Fund to help make sure Medicare stays solvent for years to come. So again, this is about getting the work done. And I would again come back to an image and a photo that Republicans like to show. And I want them to continue showing it because of the time that we're in now. The time that we're in now is that so much work hasn't gotten done. So many bridges haven't been replaced. So many places still don't have broadband. And so when they put that stack of papers on the left side, which is the Biden budget or the Evers budget, and then next to it, the thinner stack, which is, you know, what they would propose. And they want to frame it all about spending. And yes, certain people will say that and say, yeah, that's a lot. I would still contend that's an illustration of work. Who wants to get the work done? There is work to get done in this country. There is work to get done in the state. There are people who are not being treated fairly, who don't need to be brought up to the same level as a millionaire, but they certainly deserve equal opportunities to try to work hard and have a better life. It's all about equity and opportunities, not in outcomes. Now, one of the things that bothers me about this, and I'll talk to Mark Jacob about this as well an hour from now, is all the media that looked at the Biden budget proposal and they said, well, it's dead on arrival. And they looked at the Tony Evers budget and said, well, it's dead on arrival. This kind of negative framing is just so bad for civic engagement. When people feel bad about politics, it's because of something like that. Who in their right mind thinks that Republicans are just going to accept, you know, whatever Governor Evers or Joe Biden proposes right from the get-go and says, oh, my God, you wrote the perfect budget. Yes, I'm going to vote for that. It's not dead on arrival. It's an opening in negotiations. It's an opening and you go from there. So yeah, is dead on arrival technically true? Sure it is. It is in any negotiation with your first offer. But your first offer states where your values are, what you believe in. And President Biden and Governor Evers have now put that out there. They've said, our values are, we want to get the work done. We want to invest in people. We want to invest in things that have been neglected for far too long. With Republicans, we don't know yet. We know their value is to cut, to spend less, but they're afraid to put it on paper, because then we'll finally know that while everybody thinks they want to cut something for that other guy, no, they want to cut from you. When they talk about excess spending and waste, you're the excess spending and the waste that Republicans want to cut so that, you know, some more billionaires can pay a lower tax rate. So we're underway with budget negotiations. We'll follow both at the state and federal level. The feds have to finish it by October, the state by the end of June. We'll keep you updated on the values and priorities as we go along. Kia Vakil, coming up after this break. You're up, Norm. So you're a tough guy, like you really rough guy. Just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type. Back now on an early Friday morning here on Up North News Radio. And as we do each week, we check in with Kia Vakil, Courier Newsroom national correspondent out on the West Coast, where we pre-tape a little discussion about things that have been in the news. And we're going to spend a lot of time on one particular story because it's a national figure, but a Wisconsin story. And of course, it's the Wisconsin Supreme Court race. Kia, good morning. How are you?
Good. I am well, Pat. Thank you for having me.
Well, you bet. We have talked about some characters in this Wisconsin Supreme Court race. Obviously, you have Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz. You have former Justice Conservative Dan Kelly. We've talked about Dick Eline, the billionaire from the Chicago area, getting involved in the race. But there's another name people should know, as far as, you know, folks from the outside that are trying to influence this race. And this particular one, you should pay attention to him, because if one person could get credit for overturning Roe v. Wade, it would be some guy named Leonard Leo. And Kia's put a read up on upnorthnewswi.com. Tell us all about it.
Yeah. So Leonard Leo is a Virginia-based lawyer who used to run the Federalist Society, which, for those who don't know, is basically this very right-wing legal organization that has chapters at law schools all across the country, and in cities all across the country. And basically, the organization was founded because conservatives were, you know, really angry about the New Deal era and, you know, desegregation of schools and just the Supreme Court, you know, from the 40s through the 70s, that was more liberal for the first time ever. And so this organization basically exists to make the courts right-wing. And they have succeeded remarkably. Leonard Leo was considered Trump's, you know, right hand on judge nominations. All six members of the Supreme Court currently are current or former members of the Federalist Society. So it's an incredibly successful endeavor that Leo, you know, helped spearhead for years. He has since left that organization full time and now runs a network of what are called dark money groups, which are basically these political organizations that are funded by anonymous wealthy donors. And these groups have spent, he was involved with them even before he left the Federalist Society, but now it's his full-time job. And they've spent more than $500 million, you know, in the past 10, 15 years, trying to make everything in America more conservative, from abortion laws to education to businesses. And these groups have gotten involved in state Supreme Court races across the country and are now doing the same in Wisconsin.
I wanted to jump on that. When you talked a few minutes ago about the Supreme Court from the 40s to the 70s, you said becoming more liberal. And by liberal, we mean it in the classical sense of the word, more freedoms. There was the, you know, this was the era of civil rights, of you know, women had only gotten the right to vote a little bit before that, of a whole lot of marginalized groups getting freedoms they did not enjoy before. And as you said here and said in your article, by them spending $500 million, they're looking to basically rein in some of these freedoms, or, you know, or end them outright. And that is obviously something that should concern everybody in Wisconsin who might be voting in this election.
Absolutely. And I just want to clarify, that's what they've already spent last year, or in the last couple of years. They received, one of these Leo's organizations received, a $1.6 billion donation. Wow. From a manufacturing magnate who was conservative. So that's money that is in that pipeline or coming down that pipeline that is going to be spent in this quest. And that's an astronomical sum of money. And so, you know, Leo's organizations, he's obviously a very capable, very intelligent person who knows how to wield power behind the scenes. And, you know, one of these groups is called the Judicial Crisis Network. They have funneled millions of dollars to an anti-abortion group called Susan B. Anthony's Pro-Life America. One of that group's arms is now involved in the Wisconsin Supreme Court race. It's called Women Speak Out. It is actually primarily funded by Dick Uline, but it's also got money coming to it from the Leo groups. And so it's this crazy sort of web of super rich conservative donors funding groups that are supporting Dan Kelly, who would keep the abortion ban in place in Wisconsin.
Which is why I'm glad you gave the names, because again, you know, with the whole spider web of networks out there, it's important to note that if you see something, you know, with some of these names, like in this case, Women Speak Out Political Action Committee, that is a group that is trying to curtail even further women's healthcare rights. But you wouldn't know that by the title alone. And that's where folks really need to pay attention to all of these ads, because, you know, again, we can't say enough, control of the court is in the balance here.
Yeah. And they're, you know, they're not dumb. They're not going to call it billionaires want to take your rights away, political action committee. They know that no one wants that, even people who might be anti-abortion. But yeah, it's a clever, misleading name. It's funded by super rich, super anti-abortion, anti-voting rights, anti-workers' rights billionaires. And yeah, the race is obviously will determine the state of abortion laws in Wisconsin. And you know, we know Leonard Leo's. Go ahead.
Yeah, we know that this is the case, in part because Leo has been involved in a Wisconsin state Supreme Court race before. There would already be a progressive majority if Leo's groups hadn't gotten involved, you know, with some last minute ads in 2019, I believe.
Yeah, they helped fund. They, you know, gave money to a group that funded us pretty much the same amount of ads last minute to help Brian Hagedorn win his race. And, you know, it's still, we've got roughly four weeks till the election. So there's a lot of time for more money to come in. We probably won't know the full extent of the spending until, you know, late in April. And Leo personally has donated $20,000 to Dan Kelly. So it's not just his groups that are doing stuff. He's openly put a huge sum of money. $20,000 is a lot of money for most.
Yeah, that's the maximum donation. You can put millions, or as we just heard, $1.5 billion into these outside groups, but there are still spending limits on candidates, and he maxed out directly. So I mean, you see that he wants to make that difference. He saw that Brian Hagedorn only beat Lisa Neubauer by less than 1%. We saw that Ron Johnson won his reelection over Mandela Barnes by less than 1%. We have super close races here. And so it's not just that every vote matters, but it's that every last TV ad you can squeeze out of your donors could play a role as well. And as you said, it's not just here. He's worked on other state Supreme Court seats. And if you're not familiar with anybody else, you're probably familiar with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, and he plays a role there too, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's, you know, since DeSantis has taken over Florida in 2019, Leo advised him on state-level judicial appointments, helping make Florida's courts more conservative. And obviously now, you know, fast forward 4 years and Florida's, you know, looking a lot like East Germany did. And, you know, DeSantis might call it the free state of Florida, but, you know, people are getting arrested for trying to vote. Teachers are, you know, being censored. It's trans kids are having their rights taken away. There's nothing free about what's happening in Florida. And a lot of the laws that legislator is passing could be upheld by the judges DeSantis appointed that Leo advised on. So, you know, we live in a world where, you know, there's a lot of conspiracies and thoughts that there's this, you know, rich global elite that controls things. And people believe that because there's a hint of truth to it. People like Leonard Leo is a rich elite. Ron DeSantis is, you know, I don't know that he's rich, but he's quite powerful. And it's the same groups of people like him and the Ulines who are getting involved in races everywhere.
Let's turn to one other note in the news this week, and it is about President Biden putting down a plan to help extend the life of Medicare, and you know, doing so in a way that is the way you would expect. There's going to be some tax increases on the very wealthy that are in there. And look, something was going to have to be done, not because something is wrong with Medicare, but because there's this thing called demographics. And as you know, we get fewer and fewer baby boomers in the workforce, and then as taxpayers, you have to make adjustments in programs like these. And I know we've said this, you know, in past weeks, but I'm going to say it again because I know this is, you know, I'm sure this is what President Biden is saying as well to Republicans. You can grouse all you want, but could we see a plan already?
Yeah. And, you know, Biden's plan would only raise taxes on people above who earn about $400,000 a year, which is a couple percent of Americans tops. And, you know, effectively, it's going to raise taxes primarily on people like, you know, the U-lines, like Leonard Leo, like people who will not notice a 1.2% tax increase on the Medicare tax. And the vast majority, 95%+ of Americans, will not pay a penny more in taxes. His plan would make Medicare solvent for, I believe it's through the into the mid-2050s. So, you know, that's pretty much the time I would be going on Medicare. And so I would like that for it to be solvent.
It would be nice. Look, and one of the complaints against it has been that the very wealthy will be paying some of the highest marginal tax rates in the world, but they also have some of the highest incomes in the world. We've got more than one or two billionaires just here in Wisconsin alone. And so it is not untoward to see somebody like President Biden saying, yeah, maybe your marginal tax rate, which is not everything that you pay, but the margin you pay at the very highest levels of your income, is going to be a little higher than the tax rate for teachers and firefighters and what have you.
Yeah. And Biden sort of raised this point. He wrote an op-ed in the New York Times to introduce the plan. And, you know, he said, when Medicare was passed, the top 1% of Americans didn't have more than five times the wealth of the bottom 50% combined. That is the reality we live in today. So, you know, raising the Medicare tax rate, you know, by slightly over 1% on rich people, you know, they'll survive. And that means tens of millions of other Americans who work hard, who aren't born rich, who don't take advantage of tax breaks, you know, will get to rely on Medicare as they get older. And that's a big deal. And, you know, Republicans may criticize it. Their plan that is being developed is not official yet, you know, would gut Medicaid, would gut the Affordable Care Act, would gut food assistance, would gut housing assistance. So it's very much, you know, this, you know, are you going to raise taxes slightly on the rich, or are you going to absolutely decimate the poor? And that's, you know, it's pretty clear what side they're taking.
You have Akil, national correspondent for Courier Newsroom, joining us from Los Angeles. Always good to talk to you. Have a great weekend.
You too, Pat.
I was looking at the new Up North News newsletter, easy for me to say, that came out this morning. Comes out very early in the morning. Christina Lurie puts it together for us. And we've been starting a new segment with her called The Uplift, where she provides some uplifting stories that she's been covering to put on our website, put on our social media, put in our newsletter. And since I'm going to be away off and on for the next couple of weeks here with a couple of different functions, I thought since we're not going to get a chance to talk to Christina this coming Monday, I would pass along what's in the brand new newsletter, where she reviews the 9 chefs and restaurants in Wisconsin who were named semifinalists for the 2023 James Beard Awards. They include Dan Jacobs and Dan Van Wright from Esther Ev in Milwaukee for Best Chef in the Midwest, along with Gregory Leon from Amalinda in Milwaukee, Francesco Magano from Osteria Papavero in Madison. There is, let's see, Itaro Nagano and Andrew Kroger from Fairchild in Madison, a nominee for Best New Restaurant, Loopy and Iris in Milwaukee. Emerging chef would be Jamie Wong from Ahan in Madison. Outstanding pastry chef or baker, Andrew Hutchison from Madison Sourdough in Madison. A nominee for Outstanding Restaurant is Wickman House in Ellison Bay. And Outstanding Restaurateur would be Black Shoe Hospitality owners Amy and Jason Kirstein from Milwaukee and Shorewood. All of those semifinalists will find out on March 29th if they made it to the list of being a finalist, and then the winners will be announced June 5th at the James Beard Restaurant and Chef Awards Ceremony in Chicago. And there's a link here to the full list of nominees from around the country. That's in today's newsletter. You can subscribe to that newsletter by going to upnorthnewswi.com and click on newsletter in the top banner and get yourself subscribed and see some of the political stories that I'm adding and the feature stories that Christina Lurie and Sherita Booker are adding as well. Let's take a break, have a little history lesson and a music break in just a bit. You're up north. It was on this day in 1963 that people first heard this and said, there's this 12-year-old kid named Stevie Wonder. He's really good. And he continued to be really good for a long, long time to come. But back then, he was little Stevie Wonder, and that's him performing Fingertips. He did it on this day at the Regal Theater in Chicago. It was recorded, released as a single in May. And it became the first live recording to hit number one. You know, the rock era had only been, just about 10 years old at that point, and no live record had ever been number one. Little Stevie Wonder did it for the very first time with Fingertips. Now, there's some, milestone music in the music break today. There was this first album ever released, again, by somebody they hadn't heard of previously, 1967. The album was called I Never Loved a Man the Way I Loved You, and it was Aretha Franklin's first album on Atlantic Records. It had this little ditty in it. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, take F-T-C-T. And so that served as a women's anthem for quite a while. Still does, of course, but I'm just saying that there would be others that would follow, like one that hit number one on this day in 1979 by Gloria Gaynor. You're not welcome anymore. Weren't you the one who tried to hurt me with goodbye? Did you think I'd crumble? Did you think I'd lay down and die? Oh, no, not I. I will survive. All right, fun fact. Despite being the anthem for female empowerment, she didn't write the song. Two men did. One of those. Like we can't write songs. We can write songs. Aaron was caught off guard by this one, but it says here in the history books don't lie. This day in 1997 was the first episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I never watched it. I don't know if you did.
I haven't seen the whole show. I've just seen some of it. It's pretty fun.
Okay. Yeah, I never saw a single episode. So is it Allison Hannigan from How I Met Your Mother? And, that's where I know her from. And then I saw some story on TV about her role on Buffy. And apparently she was a big deal on that before How I Met Your Mother. But anyway, Chuck Norris turns 83 years old today. Wait, I'm sorry. I've just been handed a note. Chuck Norris says he's 29. Yes, Chuck Norris is 29 today because he can do that. Not 83. Sharon Stone is a senior citizen today. Sharon Stone turns 65 years old. Edie Brickell turns 57. You might remember her hit, What I Am. Actor John Hamm is 52. Rapper and composer Timbaland is 51. Carrie Underwood is 40 years old today. Olivia Wilde is 39. A lot of birthdays today. Saturday Night Live's Ego Wodum is 35. Benito Antonio Martinez Ocasio, better known as Bad Bunny. Today is his 29th birthday. And so those were the birthdays. One sad occasion to report, it was on this day in 1988 that Andy Gibb died of heart failure at the age of 30, exacerbated by drug use. His older brothers are the Bee Gees. Andy Gibb was on the cusp of, everything. In the late 1970s, he had I Just Want to Be Your Everything and Shadow Dancing, and so much more was to come. And then unfortunately, it did not. All right, I'm going to give you the news story, and then we're going to play the song, because on this day 8 years ago, 2015, A jury awarded Marvin Gaye's estate, in other words, his three children, a jury awarded Marvin Gaye's children about $7 million, finding that Robin Thicke and his song Blurred Lines was too similar to Marvin Gaye's 1977 hit, Got to Give It Up. And sometime back, Sky News in Britain did a little mashup of the two. So between Blurred Lines and Got to Give It Up, give a listen for a little bit. Tell me if you think one song was derivative of the other. By the way, it's Robin Thicke's 45th birthday today. But ladies and gentlemen of the jury, meaning Aaron, how do you rule? Was the one song so influenced by the other that it's owed co-writing billing and revenue from the sales?
I don't know. I feel like I don't know if it's so similar. Like, I think the vocal lines are very different, and I think that differentiates it enough. Because like, if rap songs can sample the entire instrumental of another song, and given I'm sure they paid for that, and it's still considered a unique song by people, I think that having a similar backing, like drum beat and bass line, is fine.
It gets into this really gray area, and I always want to be careful about it. The one I always think of is George Harrison and My Sweet Lord, and how a court ruled that he actually stole that from, was it the Chiffons with He's So Fine? They're similar, but how you're listening to, you know, He's So Fine and getting My Sweet Lord out of it is, I mean, you can say it's a function of your subconscious, but again, that means no ill intent. So yeah, what you want to do is get permission from some artist that sounds similar and say, hey, I got the song that sounds like yours. It's not really from yours, but can I cut you in on, you know, part of the, you know, the sales of it. And that's what happens. And you'll recall that yesterday we talked about, the Notorious B.I.G. Hit Hypnotize, and that, Biggie sampled that from Herb Albert's Rise. Well, interestingly, and I alluded to this, but I didn't really have a lot of time yesterday, but I did find the Billboard magazine article from 2017 where Randy Badass Alpert talks about his uncle Herb, and it was the first time he'd been asked several times if he would sell the rights or give permission to use Rise, and it was only when he heard the cassette tape of Biggie's version of this. That's when he said, this is the one I'm going to give a hit to. And interestingly, the cassette version that he heard, it was actually Biggie himself who was doing the singing. As you know, a lot of the singing of the chorus was done by a woman who's, let's see, here it is, Pamela Long was on there. But they wanted to clear the sample first. And so that's why it's actually Biggie who's singing the Biggie, 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 Can't You See part on it. And later on in the article, Albert talks about how he's, again, it's like in the movies. He's driving down the freeway. He's listening to a radio station. And he hears the last 20 seconds of the song, and the DJ starts yelling, this record's blowing up. We're playing it back to back to back. The phones are on fire, which... Look, if middle-aged guy in Chippewa Falls is telling you it's one of his favorite songs, it clearly has a good hook to it. And again, he had the good sense to clear that first with the original composer, Herb Alpert, and his nephew. So there's our music break and our history lesson for the day. We will come back after the news here, and we will talk to Wendy Strout from the Human Rights Campaign about the state Supreme Court race. You're up north.